afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darton, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, a one-man show about a San Francisco serial killer murdering gay men in the 1970s. Then a sneak peek into San Francisco's operas, La Boheme, and a documentary about the experiences and political history of caregiving. Today's show is about, caring about people that are often overlooked. That's all coming up. Stay with us. You're listening to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darton. And I just want to warn you that the following conversation may not be appropriate for kids because we'll be talking about sex and violence. During the mid-1970s, a serial killer terrorized San Francisco's queer community. He was known as the Doodler because he seduced men at bars by sketching portraits of them. Then he would lure his victims off somewhere to hook up and stab them to death. To this day, the Doodler remains on the loose. John Fisher wrote and stars in the one-man show, Doodler. The play is fictional but inspired by real events. John plays a young gay man who takes it upon himself to track the killer down after his lover is murdered. The show is currently running at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco until July 6th. And joining me is actor John Fisher. Welcome.
Hey, Janae. How are you?
Good, good. Wow. I had no idea about this. I'm born and raised in the Bay Area. This is my first time hearing of the Doodler. When did you learn about the Doodler and what brought you to this story?
I originally did this story on Zoom during COVID. So we couldn't be together as performers and audiences. So I would perform live on COVID every week. And this was a show that I did on Facebook Live and Zoom. And I didn't know about it either. The Doodler killed as many people as the Zodiac Killer, and nobody knew about him.
Now, how many people is that?
It's five.
Okay.
That we know of. So he was as prominent, as terrifying, as horrible as the Zodiac Killer. But I think because he was attacking the queer community, people weren't as concerned. Certainly the police weren't either. So I became fascinated with it, and I did this one-man show where I play all the characters. I play the Doodler at one point, and I play all the people that hunt him down.
Wow. Yeah, I read it was at least five and could be, you know, many, many more.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, too, that time during the 70s, you know, and so many people, that was especially a time, too, so many people were that couldn't come out safely. They were from other places, and they moved to the Bay Area. And so they were just really, really vulnerable. So your main character, his name is Jack, but I understand I haven't seen the play, but I understand my producer, Porfirio Rangel, saw it. But I understand he's not named in the play. Is that correct?
Yeah, he's just me. I always insert myself in these historical pieces. So I take a real event, I stick to the facts, but I put myself in it as the through line. And so it's basically me.
Okay.
John, Jack, you know, any variation on Jonathan, you know, anything like that. But I'm the through line.
Okay. Okay. And one of the other characters you play is Jay.
That's right.
Okay. And he was John's, Jack's love interest. Which one?
Yeah. He's a historic character. So he's Jack's love interest. And he's a real person who was killed by the Doodler. He was a famous drag performer in San Francisco. He performed at Pinocchio's. He was the MC at Pinocchio's. He was probably one of the most prominent drag queens in San Francisco at the time. And his career was cut short, murdered by the Doodler.
So I'm thinking, you know, and I saw pictures of him too as well, because people were talking about how beautiful he was.
Yeah.
And like you said, he was such a big star locally, you know, at that time. Why did you want to base it particularly? Because I've read different stories about the victims, but why him in particular did you want to
portray? I think he was the most uniquely San Francisco. He came here from Texas because there was nothing for him in Texas. You know, people didn't enjoy queer people there. He came here, became a drag performer, which I think is so San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Drag started in this country at Pinocchio's. I went to Pinocchio's when I was 18 and in high school, and I couldn't believe it. It was so much fun. I kept saying to my friend who took me, I said, "That is a woman. That is a real woman." And my friend said, "John, that is a man in drag." Like, you know, John, no, John, no. And I was like, no, but that's a woman. That's a woman. And I was like, John, none of those people are women. None of them. And I was like, that's when I became fascinated by drag. And so I wanted to bring that into the show. And at several points I played Jay as sort of this huge burst of energy, like just an explosion of queer energy and joy and happiness and joking and doing drag and singing songs. And then he just disappears. Mm. And that is the tragedy of the show. And that's what launches my character to find him and to find out who this doodler is and to stop him killing all these wonderful gay men who were making the city.
And at that time, was that, I guess gay sex was considered illegal?
It was just legalized. So it was legal, but you could be fired for being gay from a job. And that was the problem, because even the people who survived the doodler would not testify, because then they'd be fired from their jobs. They'd lose their jobs. Man. And it was only Harvey Milk, in response to the doodler crime, the first thing he did when he got into office was he got it written in the charter of the city of San Francisco that you cannot be fired for being gay. So it was sort of a landmark event for Harvey Milk, and drove him to change this horrible law. And only after that could people be accepted both at work and outside of work. It was legal to have gay sex. Mm-hmm. It was legal to be gay at work, to you know, for just to be open, to talk about yourself as a gay person.
I wonder too if he knew, because, you know, he knew that people couldn't disclose or people would be terrified. And so he knew he could just, terrorize people and get away with it.
That's a very good point. That's a very, very good point. Because, and also he knew that the police didn't care as much about gay people.
Right.
And that's a big part of the show. They didn't care about gay people. And so this wasn't properly investigated. And it was characters like the character I play who pushed the investigation along. And even though they never caught him, I think the growing investigation scared him off. And that's why he stopped.
I was going to ask you, like, why did he stop? Yeah, what made him stop?
I think they were just getting too close to him. And the whole community was searching for him at one point. The Rainbow Brigade was this community of self-policing gay guys who just gave up on the police. They just said, the police are not our friends. And the police were conducting raids into the Castro to beat up gay guys just because they hated them. And that's in the show too. There's a big sequence where the police are chasing gay guys with their squad cars. I play a squad car. I play cops. I play people running from the squad car. So it was a really tough time for gay men. You know, there were serial killers. There were cops who beat them up, didn't help them when they needed help. It was a really, really tough time for gay guys.
How is it for you playing all of those people? Because, again, you know, it was a tough time. It was a terrorizing time.
Yeah.
It was just a lot. I mean, it was a lot going on in that time, just in the Bay in the 70s, right? Yeah. And I'm thinking, too, just like the tensions were high. And you're reenacting all that, you know, by yourself, these different people.
Yeah, I played 15 characters.
15?
I played 15.
Oh, my goodness.
Some are German. Some are Austrian. Some are Irish. I do all my accents. I do all my body work. My mother could never, she said, sit down, eat your dinner. Because I was like jumping up and acting at the table. She called them voice explosions. Stop having voice explosions. Eat your dinner. And her problem was when she'd start laughing. She'd be yelling at me, but then she'd start laughing. I said, are you angry at me or are you amused? And she was like, I think you're very funny and very cute, but you have to eat your dinner. You can do this after dinner. I was like, I want to do it now because I have an audience. That's everybody sitting around the table. Right?
Cute,
you
know? Cute.
After dinner, I wouldn't have an audience. Everybody go to their bedrooms or go watch TV. And I was like, so, you know, this is me as a kid. I mean, acting for me has always been about being a kid, you know, just going on stage and playing. I think that's why they're called plays, because we get to play.
Right,
you know, that's
right.
I didn't know where the word came from, but I always say, when I teach, I always say, you get to go on stage and play. And if you don't have fun, the audience doesn't have fun.
Right. But I have to say, too, because, like, this is like a trauma. So
it's serious.
And, you know, because, with actors, sometimes depending on the character, they have to be very serious about leaving that character on stage when they go home. So that's why I was like, I'm amazed that you're able to do all these portrayals about something that's so traumatic.
Yeah, I cry on stage. I get very upset in the show. And then, you know, but it's like when the show's over, it's over. And it takes me time to come down. But you know, that's part of training. That's part of like, you know, you have to leave it, you know, you can't be like, you know, otherwise you turn into, you know, Marlon Brando or Robin Williams or somebody who's just like, you know, they can't let it go. They're just like on all the time, you know. And
Right,
you know,
right.
and real people have to sort of, you know, and it's like real life. It's like, and then you have to go to work, and then you have to pick up the kids, you know, then you have to walk the dog. I mean, you know, life goes on. So yeah, it's almost more upsetting to create in rehearsal than it is to perform, because in rehearsal you're discovering these things. It's like the first time you fall in love, the first time you get dumped, the first time somebody you know gets killed, and you're like, oh my God, I'm feeling all these emotions. But then you put into a play and you sort of learn to go there, do the drama, and then when it's over, you know, you go home.
If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with actor and playwright John Fisher. His one-man show, Doodler, is currently running at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco until July 6th. And I know you've done research on this. What was it about him that drew people? And I'm thinking because, you know, again, he would be in bars. I understand he was a really good artist, and so he would draw these portraits of men. And I even thought about that too as a bait. As far, and maybe I'm going too deep into this, as far as you, I'm thinking of people who are not feeling seen, maybe people who aren't feeling beautiful because of society. And then he draws these images of them, and that just seduces. I used to study psychology, so maybe, like I said, I might be going too deep. But just even that kind of bothered me too when I found out how he lured his victims.
Janae, that's the first person who said something like that. And I think that that's actually spot on. I have always struggled with what so much about the drawing appealed to people. He would draw people in bars and go up to them and say, look, I drew this picture of you. And I think you've hit the nail on the head, because one of the characters says, nobody has ever drawn my picture before. And all the characters say, is that me? And I think you're hitting on something that I only intuited, which is that they're like, wow, I look great.
Right.
You know? And I think that he did. I think he did draw them people, and it got people laughing, and it got people connected. And he was like, you know, do you want to go out to the beach with me? And they're like, you know, it was the 70s, and it's like he was younger than most of his
Okay.
victims. And I think that I think you're absolutely right. I think that he appealed. It's funny. I can play these characters every night, but you've like hit on something that I, as an actor, am just sort of intuiting, which is that yes, they're seeing themselves in a flattering portrait. They like this guy, and they feel safe with him because he likes them.
Right. And then him sketching them say is him saying, I see you, right? When other
Yes.
people didn't. And the
Right.
fact that he used that to his
And
advantage is.
bar life can be that way. You know, you can be sitting at a bar and not feel like you're seen.
Yeah.
Feel like, yeah, and he zeroes in on them. And I think he liked them. I mean, he had sex with them. I think he did like them, but then this self-hate kicked in. So he was crazy. I mean, he was schizo. He didn't have control.
Yeah.
So he went to extremes, and then he had to erase the sin.
And again, you researched, you know, this story, and you talked to people who lived in San Francisco at the time. What were some of the things that they said that stuck with you?
Well, it's very interesting. A lot of people didn't know about the crime. So talking about, you know, you talked about a serial killer when you were living in Los Angeles who you didn't know about.
Right.
And that was true of a lot of people I talked to. They said, I never heard about this until much later. So it's like, it's amazing how something like this can happen and people don't cover it. And other people talked about how unsafe the Castro could feel a lot of the time, because there was a lot of violence. There were two other serial killers killing gay guys at the time, the Tenderloin Slasher and the South of Market S&M Killer. So they got three people killing, and they're not quite sure who did what sometimes. But also the police, and that is really upsetting. The police could be incredibly violent towards the gay community. And that was shocking too, to hear gay men say that.
So I read in 2023, that the San Francisco Police Department, they released a sketch that showed how likely the doodler would look after, you know, after all of these years. And who is this guy? Who do they think he is? And
Well, I don't. I object to that sketch because, first of all, it's not the doodler. It's a sketch of somebody who committed crimes that were kind of similar, but they weren't the doodler crimes.
Now, why do you think he was the doodler?
I think that they just are desperate, and they're saying that this guy who committed these other crimes must be the doodler because they happened at the same time. There are other suspects. I think it's irresponsible of the police because that suspect who they've flooded the internet with is Black. So what this has become is this Black versus white crime. And that's not, I don't think that's not what it was. That's not what it was.
Was there anybody that survived or got away from him, or like anybody that remembers seeing him in a bar?
No. No, they're the five victims never, they're dead. The sketch is based on a victim of another crime, and the only similarity is a knife. I mean, a gay guy got attacked with a knife viciously, but there wasn't the doodle of him. There wasn't the beach, which is where all the other crimes happened. There wasn't the multiple stabbings. So I think the police have been pretty irresponsible with that sketch because it's turned this crime into something it's not. Mm. They've made it sound like the zebra murders, and it's not. So I don't subscribe to that sketch. I don't think that is the doodler. There is another suspect who is a blonde white guy, and that was never pursued. So I don't know what, the police, I can't explain their obsession with that sketch and the aging sketch and saying this guy's still alive. Maybe this guy is still alive. Maybe he did commit these other crimes, but those other crimes did not result in murder. Mm-hmm. And they're only similar to the doodler murders in that there was a knife involved.
Somebody had to have seen him. I mean, somebody sitting in a bar sketching people, that's rare. Somebody has to know.
Right. And that's what I'm saying is this guy was not, he didn't sketch people in bars. Mm. So, you know, the people out there who they interviewed were very specific, and it wasn't, this sketch does not align with the specifics of the crimes. So I think they're chasing the wrong villain. And frankly, I think it's kind of, you know, incendiary what they've done. Mm-hmm. I don't go there in the show with regards to that particular suspect because I don't agree with them. I just don't agree with them.
So it's Pride Month. And when I heard about this show, I said, this is an interesting show.
Yeah.
To have during Pride.
Yeah.
Why now? Why have the show now this month?
Well, it really is about the perseverance of the gay community and fighting back. And they fight back against the police. They hunt down doodler. It's really about the strength of queer people. And even to this day, we see they're not going to take it. Trans people are not going to take it. Gay people are not going to take it. No. The era of us just sort of accepting that we're bad and keeping our mouths shut and sneaking around is over. And so it really is about pride. It's about pride in yourself. And there's a lot of humor in the piece. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of joy in the piece. The first chunk of the piece is about a romance between Jay and Jack and how very much in love they are. And just Jack just explodes with love of this drag queen. And that's what motivates this effort to find this person who's destroying all these wonderful people. So really it is about pride, and it's an action adventure piece more than anything. But yeah, it was a dark, people think of the 70s is like free love and San Francisco, let's go to San Francisco and just have sex and drugs and all that stuff. And it's all gonna be great. But there was a dark underbelly, and I think it's important to see that gay men fought back.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Well, I didn't see the show, but my KLW colleagues, a few of them did, and they really enjoyed the show and were really touched by it. So, John Fisher, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Janae. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I love this show. So it's an honor to be here and a pleasure.
Oh, you got to come on back.
I would love to.
All right. I've been speaking with actor and playwright John Fisher. His one-man show, Doodler, is currently running at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco until July 6th. And coming up, a documentary and event about caregiving. Stay with us. Welcome Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden. Caregiving is one of the most important acts of love you can give someone, but it can be tough too. This Saturday, KALW is hosting Caregiving for Caregivers. The day-long event features wellness activities, resources, and discussions about caregiving. Which leads me to my next guest, Chris Durrance. He's the director and senior producer of the PBS documentary Caregiving. The film tells stories of caregivers and gives historical context to why caregivers don't get enough federal support. Now here's a clip of elder and family care expert, Ai-Jen Poo.
What we have in the United States is a situation where every single day, 10,000 people turn 65. And because of advances in healthcare and technology, people are living longer than ever before. We've got none of the systems or policies in place to support a quality of life for that extended period. And on the other end of the generational spectrum, we've got millennials giving birth. 4 million babies are born every year in this country. And so, across the generational spectrum, we need more care than we ever could have imagined or that we've ever designed for.
KALW is partnering with PBS and the Caregiving documentary for our big event on Saturday. Here's my conversation with filmmaker Chris Durrance. Chris Durrance, welcome.
Thanks so much, Janae. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, I'm really just grateful that you made this documentary on caregiving. As I was telling you earlier before this interview, before we started recording, I've been a part-time caregiver. I'm kind of still a caregiver. I took care of my grandmother when she had dementia. I helped my mom take care of her. I helped my family take care of my grandfather when he had cancer. I had another great aunt that had cancer, so I've helped taking care of a lot of elders, several elders, another grandfather with cancer. So I've been taking care of a lot of folks, and I have a 91-year-old grandmother, and sometimes she calls me over, and I got to go over there and cook dinner for her and make her laugh. So I really related to a lot, a lot of things in this film. Are you a caregiver?
So I have three kids. Two of those kids have conditions that require some intermittent care, and so it's been something that for our family we've been navigating, and it certainly opened my eyes to the importance of care. You mentioned joy as well. You mentioned making your grandmother laugh. And I think that's something that's often forgotten in the equation. We often think of it as just work and really hard work, and it is. But I think when people get that care encompasses all kinds of things, emotional support, mm-hmm. love, sometimes just sitting with someone, sometimes just sitting quietly with someone, making them laugh, bringing joy, that it has these moments of joy, and that is so important. And I think a lot of your listeners will relate to this. Care is the ultimate human connection. It really is.
Mm. Yeah, because sometimes my grandmother, she'll just call me to come over, or I get a sense, she just wants some company. And so, yeah, I'll come in to sit with her, and we'll just chit-chat and talk, and yeah. And she loves to read, so I'll bring her books, and we talk about the books that she reads.
That is just a beautiful thing. One of the things my wife does, you can tell from my accent, I'm English in origin, as is my wife, and her mother lives in England. And so one of the things that they do is she reads to her mother. My wife reads to her mother every night over the phone, and it's just this lovely connection. They choose a book and then they read a chapter every night. So that connection, that reading, that listening, that presence, that companionship, that's care. They can't be in the same country together. They can't be in the same room together at the moment, but that care crosses those boundaries and is so profound.
Wow, that's beautiful too. You're talking about your mother-in-law and your children, caring for them. Is that what prompted you, or they what prompted you to cover caregiving?
Actually, no. Like many people, I didn't identify as a caregiver. I think that's one of the challenges, one of the reasons why there's almost this silence or this absence of recognition for caregivers, is that many of the caregivers themselves don't even identify them as caregivers. It's what they do. they just look after a grandparent, or they look after a sibling, or they look after a parent. And if you ask them, are you a caregiver, they'd say no. But then if you said, well, do you take them to medical appointments? Do you help them prepare meals? Do you help translate for them? Do you help run errands for them? Do you take them out and get them to a community center once a week? And they'd say, yes, yeah, I do all of those things. Well, then that is care. That is caregiving. Mm-hmm. And so you are. And I think we find that most people in America do those things in their families, for their neighbors, in their communities, but don't identify as caregiving. And so there is this, it's almost like this social silence about this topic of caregiving. I went through that journey myself. When the story is something that I've been talking about with the people I work with at PBS about 5 years ago, and it felt like something we needed to do because it felt like this was a hugely important untold story. But it was only in the course of making it that I was able to reflect on how important it was in my own life and learn from the film I was making and how that all of those lessons could apply to me personally at home. So it was a really interesting reversal.
What I really love about this film, too, is the data and the history that's in the film. So I just want to go back to some of the data. Caregiving work is done mostly by women. Majority are women of color and unfortunately underpaid. I was shocked, and I was not, but I was reading the average salary is $23,700 for people.
It's astonishing.
And you live in New York. I'm here in the Bay Area. $23,700
It's not a living wage.
It's not a living
and this
wage.
And this is some of the most important work that we would ever entrust to anyone. I mean, caring for a loved one, caring for a parent, caring for a spouse, caring for a child. So this is this disparity between the value of the work, the importance of the work, the importance of the work in terms of enabling the whole economy to function, enabling families to function, and what we pay the professional, these professional caregivers, that salary of $23,900 a year on average across the country. Yeah. That gap. And then family caregivers, there's between 50 million and 105 million family caregivers, and the vast, vast majority of them get nothing.
Right. And you mentioned in the film that if we were to calculate, you know, how much they would be paid, it would equate to $600 billion.
Yeah, this is a huge, this is the backbone of the economy. And so that silence about caregiving is profoundly consequential, not just for family, but for businesses. And I think it's just so important that we bring this story out of the shadows and into the boardrooms of our companies, into the homes, that we give people permission to talk about it, that we erase often people feel shame about admitting that they're a caregiver, telling a coworker.
Now, why is that?
I don't know.
But
you must have experienced this yourself. If you have to, say you have to change an appointment at work or leave a meeting early because you have to care for your grandmother, she's just called you and you have to step out. I think most people, if it was a child, they would be happily tell their co-workers that this was the case. You know, I've got to go and see, you know, a soccer game, or they, you know, my five-year-old has a dance recital at her school. I'm going to leave at 3 o'clock so I can catch that. Everyone would be sympathetic and would rejoice and just say, absolutely, go ahead and go do that. But for some reason, I think for many of us, were that moment an appointment for a grandparent who had dementia, or were there an appointment for a spouse who, you know, who has had a stroke or who is going through cancer treatment? It feels like we just haven't caught up to the needs to the needs of families, to the real lives that families are living in America today, where care is just we have to provide it to our loved ones. I don't know why. So I hope we erase that.
I wonder, too, if it's that, because when I was watching your film, I was thinking about, you know, in our society, this whole pull yourself up by your bootstrap. And some people maybe consciously or unconsciously look down on people when they're sick, because it's like you're looked at as weak.
Maybe and look down on themselves. You know, maybe that. Maybe
and that too,
maybe we're taught to look down on ourselves, that we are weak. We're not strong enough. We're not resilient enough if we can't cope. And so we then push ourselves over the edge. And it's why so many caregivers have, you know, suffer from mental health challenges. They suffer from financial burdens of caregiving and can't talk about that. And they, you know, in some cases, sadly, they're passing before the person that they're caring for because they're putting themselves under such strain.
I know someone that happened to, they were caregiving for their mother, and they died before their mother did. It's a deep topic. And I was sick in 2023, and I'm thinking too when you're talking about how maybe sometimes we internalize our own, you know, issues of weakness, you know, when we're sick. And I was in 2023, I was sick the whole year, and I needed help. I couldn't cook for myself, and thankfully friends and family, they would cook for me and bring me food because I was sick until I had to get surgery. But if you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with filmmaker Chris Durrance. He's the director and senior producer of the documentary Caregiving, which you can stream on PBS.org. KALW is partnering with PBS and the Caregiving documentary for a big event on Saturday afternoon, June 21st. KALW is hosting the event Caregiving for Caregivers, and that's at our downtown San Francisco location at 220 Montgomery. Chris, I want to talk about, again, you did your research, which I figured you would. It's PBS, and you're a good filmmaker. But there was so much history. I mean, that's what was really interesting to me, looking at events in U.S. history that has shaped how we look at care, has shaped why a lot of caregivers don't have enough support, has shaped why it's so expensive. You mentioned Frances Perkins, who was the U.S. Secretary of Labor under FDR, World War II, decisions made by President Nixon, Lyndon B. Johnson, the Vietnam War, just when veterans were coming back. What were some historical moments that stood out for you in the U.S. as far as how healthcare and just caring has evolved or not evolved enough in this country?
Janae, I am so glad that you brought up this. Because when we were making the film, we realized that for most people, their experience of care starts with a phone call. Something has happened to a family member. And from that moment on, life is a scramble. It's a scramble to figure out what services you can get, what financial support you can get. It's just like morning, noon, and night, 24/7. You'll know this yourself. Just trying to figure out how to help that person. And what every caregiver will know firsthand is that they are dealing with this patchwork of supports from the place they live, their state, federal government, depending on how old they are, what the condition is, eligibility, how sick the person is. And so it's a really complicated system to navigate. They're often juggling a job themselves, and maybe they're juggling their own kids that they have, and they're in the sandwich generation. And what most of us don't realize is that there's a reason why, there's a story that has brought us to this point. The reason why they're navigating this complex patchwork of a system is because it's a product of decisions that have been made by the politicians who serve us over the years. And what we also realized is that while we have a story of our country, you know, the Pilgrim Fathers and the Civil War and the Great Depression and the heroism of our soldiers in World War II and so on, we have this history of our country, but what we don't have is a collective care history. We don't appreciate the care journey that we've been on. And so we really, really wanted to tell that story and weave that in with the lived experience of caregivers. And as you said, it's a story that starts in the Great Depression. Before the Great Depression, there basically was no welfare. There was no support for families. And it takes this legend of American history, Frances Perkins, the first woman to serve in the cabinet, the only woman in FDR's cabinet in the 1930s. And she builds the Social Security Act, and provides the first care infrastructure, kind of care network, care safety net for American families. Also provides the first programs for people with disabilities and some other things. But she builds that. And then when we build Medicaid and Medicare, terms that, you know, that all of your listeners will be very familiar with, those are built on the back of Social Security. Those are actually part of the Social Security Act from 1935. Mm-hmm. They are additions to that act. And so we really wanted to tell this story. You mentioned World War II. Few people know that in World War II, we built a pretty robust system of childcare centers across the country near defense plants, because we knew we wanted to get women into the workforce. And how did you get women into the workforce? Well, you had to provide childcare so that those women could work. And so we did. We realized that it was infrastructure that was needed in this wartime emergency. And so we built them. After the war, there was a big fight. And they got closed down. The funding got ended, and we closed down. A group of very brave women and courageous women, politically active women, tried again in the 1970s and came vanishingly close to getting it. They passed a childcare support bill through Congress. Again, most people don't know this history. They passed that through Congress, mm-hmm. and it was vetoed by President Nixon. So we came this close to having national childcare support for American families. And the Vietnam War, and so we tell, is another important moment in our history. And so for people that watch the film, I hope that they get not just a sense of present day stories that resonate with them, that move them, but also a sense of the journey that our country has been on. And more importantly, they feel inspired to be a part of writing the next chapter in our own care story, because it is up to us as citizens of this country to write the next chapter in the care story of our country. So I hope that that it's not just history for history's sake, but it's living history. It's history that inspires people to think about where we are today and where we want to go, what the country that we want to build in terms of care.
Yeah, the history really was just, I mean, I love learning history. And so I just thought that was so important. And I just really appreciate all the information in there, because I learned a whole lot. If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with filmmaker Chris Durrance. He's the director and senior producer of the documentary Caregiving, which you can stream on PBS.org. KALW is partnering with PBS and the Caregiving documentary for a big event on Saturday afternoon, June 21st. KALW is hosting Caregiving for Caregivers, and that's at our downtown San Francisco location, 220 Montgomery. You know, there's history, and again, there's personal stories. You showed us different types of caregivers. You showed us parents. You showed us adult children taking care of parents, spouses taking care of each other, a child. You showed us a child taking care of their mother with MS. And here's a clip of 14-year-old Jacob Gutierrez and his mom, Jennifer. They're in the kitchen cooking pasta for dinner.
My mom has MS, so, and like some days she can feel good, some days she can feel bad. And on those days, it's hard to see her struggle.
I don't like asking for help.
But it's incredibly hard.
Jacob!
Yes?
Can you open this?
I could try. I've always been a big help. I make sure that she takes her medicine.
Jacob, these my hands, because I don't feel my fingers anymore. All right, I'm gonna go lay down.
All right.
I love you.
Feel better, okay?
Okay, thank you for cooking.
You're welcome. And I'm not complaining, because I'm glad that I'm a caregiver. I'm glad that I'm able to help my family.
So, Chris, why did you want to show so many different types of people in this role of caregiving? Because you really expanded, for me, as far as what a caregiver is, what they look like, age, everything.
What we wanted to do was show the kaleidoscope of the care experience in America today. I think when one says the word caregiving, there's an image that comes to mind. And it's usually someone older, someone maybe in assisted living, maybe someone going through cancer treatment, or someone with Alzheimer's or another dementia. And you hinted at this in your question. What we wanted to do was show people that care is much more broadly experienced than that in this country today, that there are millions, at least 5 million kids who provide regular care to another family member, maybe a sibling, maybe a parent, it may be a grandparent. That's 5 million. That is just a huge, huge number. We wanted to show people that while, yes, most care is done by women and women of color, 40% of caregivers at the moment are thought to be men as well. Millions and millions of men are providing care. Mm-hmm. We wanted to show that the sandwich generation experience, what it's like to be thrust into care just from one day to the next. I found that story of Jacob and his mum, Jennifer, and her husband, Mike, so powerful, so moving. And what I find there is that it reveals a beautiful thing about caregiving, which is that what you have in that family is this triangle of care, that while Jennifer, the mother in the family, is suffering from multiple sclerosis and needs the care of her child, needs the financial support from her husband and care from her husband, she's also the matriarch of the family. She's the one that pays the bills. She's the one that is helping her kid get ready for his first day of high school. She's the one who's asking him how his day went when he goes to this brand new school. She's still the mother. And when you see the kid, Jacob, he still needs his mother, and he talks about that. So while he's helping her in the kitchen, while he's getting her medicines, he's still the 15-year-old kid that needs a mom. And when you see Mike, you see this husband who is coping with FMLA. He has to take time off work to look after his wife, but he's not earning money. That puts him in this financial hole. So he needs to be the provider, but he also needs care. He needs the emotional support from his wife and from his kid to help him get through the struggles that they're dealing with. So you get this powerful, resonant human triangle of care where each is receiving care and each person is giving care. And that's one of the reasons why I love that story and find that it just resonates so much with people who get to see the film.
It shows how layered caregiving is and really how everybody needs support. Everybody. Also in this documentary, we see the beauty of caregiving. We talked about that earlier, just bonding with loved ones and having that special time with them, even though it can be hard, but also to building community. So we see, you know, organizations and people advocating on Capitol Hill for more resources, more support for caregivers. So there's heavy stories in there, but there's also two stories that give you some hope. And I wanted to know, like, do you think there will be a future where this country will have federal caregiving support? I know, you know, we're still trying to even just fight for universal health care, but do you see that? I mean, are activists feeling hopeful about that?
I think one of the things that we wanted this film to do was take caregiving out of the shadows, to make caregiving front and center in the American conversation today, and have people think about what kind of care support they want. And that can come at many different levels. That can come on your street, in your neighborhood, in your community, through your church. It can come through your employer. It can come through the school. You know, imagine there are 5 million kids who regularly provide care. Most schools have no clue that these kids are doing that. For them, they'll see a kid that's tired or a kid that's late for first period or a kid that doesn't hand their homework in. So that kid is most likely to get detention. What they need is support. So imagine if we encourage school districts, all our local school districts, to just ask their student body in middle schools and high schools if they are providing care and how many hours a week are they doing that. The places that do that, Rhode Island has started doing that. They found that in some schools, 40% of children in those schools were providing hours and hours of care a week. 40%. That is a huge, huge number of kids. Imagine if other school districts did the same and started changing things. So, yes, we can look to Washington. We can look to the federal government to answer some of these questions. But we can also use these stories to think about what we can do in our own community, in our schools. We can encourage employers. Many employers want to provide care policies, but they have old childcare policies from the 1980s. They were hard fought for by the women of, you know, of the 1960s and 1970s. Really, really huge battles to get those childcare policies. Now, let's make them care policies so that they benefit everyone, not just families with young children. Some employers do that, but a lot don't. Let's encourage them to step up. And so we can start to build this next chapter, and we can build it from the bottom up, and we can also try and build it from the top down. But it's on us to envisage the next chapter and then to bring it into being.
How did Bradley Cooper, because he's one of the executive producers, and he talked about taking care of his father who was ill. How did he become part of this project?
He became involved because, as you said, his father had lung cancer, and he ended up moving in with him, spending the last 8 months back in his old family home, caring for his dad. And what he saw firsthand was that for all the resources that he had at his disposal, for all the money that he had, caregiving was one of the hardest things that he had ever had to do. And so he resolved to be a part in trying to tell the story of caregiving. And that became the genesis of this project, the origins of this project. And we're so profoundly grateful to him for that.
Chris, again, thanks to you and your team for bringing us this documentary. It's really powerful and moving. And thank you for just helping those of us who do caretaking feel more seen.
I really appreciate it, Janae. Thank you so much for shining a light on it as well and sharing it with your listeners.
Chris Durrance is the director and senior producer of Caregiving. You can stream it on the PBS website or app. Check out KLW's Caregiving for Caregivers event this Saturday. Learn some wellness activities, get resources, and hear discussions about caregiving with KLW's own Rose Aguilar. And we'll have a link on our website. Coming up, an opera about friends and their romance drama in 19th century Paris. We'll be back. Listening to the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darton. The San Francisco Opera's production of La Boheme is wrapping up this week. It's about four roommates in Paris, a poet, a painter, a philosopher, and a musician. The story begins around 1830 on Christmas Eve, and that's the night when poet Rodolfo meets Mimi, a young neighbor who knocks on his door asking for a light for her candle. And in the opera, they navigate their romance and Mimi's illness. Actress Karen Chow Ling Ho plays Mimi, and here she is introducing herself to Rodolfo. She is singing about her love of springtime. That was Karen Chow Ling Ho. The remaining shows of the San Francisco Opera's La Boheme runs tonight through Saturday. And that's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darton. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you so much for tuning in. We appreciate you. There's some things to do this weekend. This Saturday, June 21st, Berkeley Poet Laureate Aya de Leon presents Formation, and it's for all ages, and the lineup includes freedom songs, a hip-hop high school dance, spoken word, live music, dancing for adults, games, virtual art making, and it's all at the La Peña Cultural Center in Berkeley, and the activities are free and low cost. On Friday and Saturday, the Bronx Revolution and the Birth of Hip-Hop is going to be at the Yerba Buena Center in San Francisco, and there'll be hip-hop pioneers and break dancing and just all different types of art and all kind of good stuff and some discussions too as well, I believe on Saturday. And we lost some Bay Area legends this week. Rest in peace to Yoshi's co-founder, Kaz Kajimura, and radio icon Leslie Stovall. They made a huge impact to music and entertainment in the Bay Area. We all have been to Yoshi, just about all of us, and I've been listening to Leslie Stovall since I was a little girl, so definitely her loss is definitely hitting those of us in the radio community and her listeners. And we'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. It's Juneteenth tomorrow, so enjoy the day. Take the day off, learn some history. My ancestors were from Texas, so Juneteenth means a lot to me as well, so I can definitely relate to that history. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other. Take care of each other. That's what the show is about today.